could be sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village, from 1901 to 1925. By Jane Toy Coolidge. Chapter 7, The Dances. A child's memories are like the pictures made by a kaleidoscope. Bright fragments of color haphazardly tumbled together. For a little girl in Chapel Hill, some of these bright fragments had to do with the college balls held at commencement and referred to as the dances. For the 2 days devoted to the dances every June, the campus became not a seat of learning but a glamorous stage where bows and bells reveled in a whirl of gaiety. The University of North Carolina was a school for gentlemen, and the old Southern code of gentlemanly conduct prevailed. There were rules, unspoken but nonetheless honored, of social behavior, rules laid down by tradition and zealously maintained year after year. Fraternities were the social arbiters, and their power was absolute. If there was snobbishness, there were also high principles of conduct carried out by fine young men, some of whom were destined to become leaders in state government and industry. Non-fraternity men withstood the system, and many of these, too, became leaders on the campus and in the wider arenas of later years. But during the dances, fraternity men held sway, joined together in the German club, which was officially in charge of everything. Tradition was strictly followed, and though high spirits caused some questionable escapades, there was an atmosphere of stylized elegance. Of course, invitations to the dances were at a premium among young ladies all over the state. Invitations promised 2 days of glamorous pleasure, spiced with all imaginable thrills, and they conferred on lucky recipients the status of acknowledged belles. No wonder bids were strenuously sought after and wangled for with all the wiles known to womankind. To a little girl living in Chapel Hill, there was something magical about the dances. Excitement was so thick in the air that even children breathed it in. We knew about dancing because we'd been taken at an early age to a dancing class under the direction of Miss Louise and Miss Canty Venable, and now the beruffled little girls and Eton-collared boys, who were members of the class, were allowed to go to the afternoon dance that opened the festivities. This was held in Commons Hall, a long, low, brown wooden building on the southwest edge of the campus. Ordinarily, this served as the students' dining room, a drab place haunted by the ghosts of last year's meals. But now, lavishly festooned with blue and white streamers, it was an enchanted palace. The youngsters made a few tentative excursions onto the dance floor, going through the motions of the two steps and waltzes they had been taught. But mostly, they stared wide-eyed at the beautiful ladies and their dashing escorts. They were given programs, too, little folded cards with tasseled silk cords to hang from your finger. But such days of glory for Commons Hall were not to last. The Bynum Gymnasium was built, a large, handsome structure, at the other end of the campus, and this provided a more spacious and elegant setting for the dances. Still, the old traditions persisted. They reached their climax at the final ball, when there was a dramatic pause at the close of the grand march, and the marshal and the ball managers presented their regalia to their partners. These coveted insignia of office were wide sashes of heavy satin, their alternating folds of blue and white held together by richly decorated college emblems, below which extended fringed satin ends. Worn over one shoulder, and passing diagonally across the wearer's breast, the regalia made an impressive sight, elegantly beautiful and a symbol of social triumph. To own one was the heart's desire of many a Carolina belle. Of course, we youngsters never had the thrill of seeing these presentation ceremonies, but we heard all about them, and we loved the story of a long-ago commencement ball when a Chapel Hill girl, beautiful and charming and adored by numerous suitors, couldn't accept her invitation because she was a Methodist and dancing was forbidden by the church. She was Miss Etty Mangum. Her real name was Juliet, but I never knew this till I grew up. And she lived in a big house on Rosemary Lane, later owned by the writer Betty Smith. Here on the wide front porch, Miss Etty sat alone on the night of the ball, listening to a mockingbird high up in the cedar tree, and watching the moon make its slow journey across the sky. She may have been sad, but I don't think so, for she knew what was coming. And then it came. Hurried footsteps on the graveled walk, and a young man in white tie and tails, carrying something in his arms. As he leapt up the steps, the moonlight shone upon his burden, and the satin of the regalia shimmered with a luster all its own. Miss Etty rose from her chair and stepped forward to meet him. He slipped the trophy over her shoulder and, I hope, took her in his arms and kissed her. When I knew Miss Etty, she was an elderly lady, gentle and sweet and kind, still living in the big house on Rosemary Lane. She had never married. Was it because she had so many suitors she couldn't make up her mind? But she gave no evidence of regret. There was a dreamy, faraway look in her eyes, as if she were looking back into the past and seeing pleasant things. Of course, the dances were just one feature of commencement week. But speeches, alumni reunions, trustee meetings, and the like meant nothing to children. They were routine occurrences habitually ignored. One exception to this rule was the academic procession, for it was fun to gather on campus and watch our fathers and their colleagues hurry along, their black gowns billowing as they took their places in the long line and marched to Memorial Hall. This remarkable building stood facing Cameron Avenue, west of Girard Hall. Built just before the turn of the century, it was an architect's dream turned nightmare. A vast oval structure, reminiscent of a kneeling elephant, with two turtles in front for ears. Pseudo-Gothic in style, it had no central supports. The enormous roof curved upwards to the summit, where small gables surrounded an oblong area shaped like a coffin. Perhaps this was an evil omen, for it was said that the builder had died before the hall was completed, and that money had run out. The building presented grave problems from first to last. Acoustics were dreadful, and there were no public address systems to remedy them. The place was like a huge egg-shaped barn, and, after some 50 years of unsatisfactory use, it was declared unsafe and torn down. But while it lasted, Memorial Hall was impressive. Commencement speakers shouted their words of wisdom into its hollow spaces. Black-gowned professors sat in dignified rows on the wide stage, and generations of seniors received their diplomas under its ill-fated dome. The building had one virtue. It was big enough to hold everybody. Faculty, trustees, visiting dignitaries, graduates with their proud families, and country people from all over Orange County who came in buggies and wagons for a picnic. Palm-leaf fans ruffled the hot air, while orators held forth and a campus dog or two wandered in and out, secure in knowledge of privileged status. Commencement visitors strained the housing facilities of the village to the bursting point, facilities that at best were few and far between. Pickard's Hotel on Franklin Street, near the Presbyterian Church, and the Central Hotel, on the site of the present-day Baptist Church, took care of drummers who came to take orders for their wares, but these accommodations were limited and far from suitable for distinguished VIPs. A dearth of places in which to house visiting notables seems to have plagued Chapel Hill through the years, for when President James K. Polk came to visit his alma mater in 1847, it was necessary to put up a sizable building to take care of him and his entourage. This was the Inn, a rambling brown wooden structure facing Franklin Street, on the edge of the campus, near where the Moorhead Planetarium now stands. This, of course, is not to be confused with the modern Carolina Inn. By the turn of the century, it had degenerated into a state of musty neglect. Impecunious students occupied some of its shabby rooms, and, on rare occasions, the dusty foyers were opened for such functions as the King's Daughter's Bazaar. The only acceptable accommodations for commencement visitors were in private homes or boarding houses, and these were bespoken months in advance. Faculty families entertained friends and relatives with proverbial southern hospitality, and in case of need, rented spare rooms to well-recommended strangers. During the dances, girls slept three and four in a bed, and many on the floor. VIPs fared better, for they were given the red carpet treatment in professors' homes, where such visits were an accepted part of college life. Faculty children sat at table, listening to their parents' conversation with distinguished guests, and absorbing worldly knowledge in the process. My father was in charge of securing preachers for the university sermons scheduled once a month, probably to counteract the charges of campus godlessness that swept over the state from time to time. Services were held in Girard Hall, we called it the chapel, and outstanding ministers were invited to preach. My father selected these gentlemen, made arrangements for their visits, and, more often than not, entertained them in our home. The size of our spacious house on West Franklin Street made this possible. There was always a cook in the kitchen, and my mother was a gracious hostess. As late as 1916, this hospitable custom continued, for it was at about this time that the English poet, Alfred Noyes, came to lecture and read his poems to us. His appearance had been arranged by the English department, of which Dr. Edwin Greenlaw was the head, and the poet stayed in the Greenlaw home. When, after a thrilling evening, I can still hear Mr. Noyes tlot, 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 as his highwayman galloped down the ribbon of moonlight, Mrs. Greenlaw, on her way to bed, was surprised by the sight of unfamiliar objects on the floor outside the guest room door. In true English fashion, the poet had put out his shoes to be cleaned. She rose to the occasion, took the shoes down to the kitchen, and gave them the polish of their lives. When William Howard Taft came to lecture, he was entertained by President and Mrs. Venable in the columned mansion on East Franklin Street, then quite new. Mrs. Venable, a famous housekeeper, served pigs in blankets, that's oysters wrapped in bacon, and these so delighted Mr. Taft that he ate too many and suffered unpleasant consequences. Needless to say, his hosts suffered equally trying moments of anxiety. The new president's house was the scene of parties of high style and elegance. Its spacious rooms and wide open spaces were designed for entertaining, and a succession of first ladies used them to full advantage. On special occasions, the president's receptions were held, functions carefully planned long in advance, and carried out with grace and skill. Faculty wives noted for charm and social expertise were stationed at the entrance and in the doorways between other rooms. They greeted the guests, chatted with easy gaiety, and kept the crowd moving in the right direction so expertly that no one knew they were doing it. In the dining room, other ladies sat behind silver and tea coffee services at the long table loaded with tempting delicacies. Teenage faculty daughters served these refreshments, passing around tiny sandwiches, lovely little cakes, and ice cream molded in the shape of fruits and flowers. For these growing girls, it was a demonstration of what is now called gracious living. Horrid phrase. A fine art so charmingly carried out that it made a lasting impression, serving as a standard of comparison by which similar social functions all over the world were judged. Visiting celebrities, influential trustees, and countless loyal supporters of the university attended these receptions, besides faculty members and other members of the college staff. In the guest lists of the early days, there was a sharp line of distinction between town and gown, but when Edward Kidder Graham was president, Mrs. Graham broke this precedent and included many village people. She was a liberal and lovable woman, as brilliant a leader in the community as her husband was in wider fields. Both of them died young, before the fruition of outstanding careers. Mr. Graham, a victim of the 1918 epidemic of Spanish influenza. Their loss was one of Chapel Hill's great tragedies. These memories are fragments in the kaleidoscopic view of a Chapel Hill childhood. Added to less colorful recollections, they form the framework of a serene, orderly existence that, seen from a distance, appears to have been a pleasant ivory tower. And there were everyday happenings that were meaningful in their own way, reaching deep into the individual heart. For a little girl living in the big house on West Franklin Street, hours spent in its attic were experiences of this kind. The attic covered the whole house and rose in the middle to a height of some 30 feet, a plan no doubt designed to keep the rooms below cool in summer. It was completely floored except for outer edges under the eaves, and there was room not only for family furniture and trunks, but for numerous bulky objects belonging to other people. Friends moving from house to house or going away for a year's sabbatical leave knew that the toys had a place to store their possessions, and my parents were glad to do so. Even so, the attic was never crowded. At the edge of the floor, extending across the front, were shelves filled with books and magazines in orderly rows and neat piles. In the center, between the shelves, was a large double window below a gable under which the space was floored to make a large alcove that was like a small room. I appropriated this choice spot for my own. A small sofa formerly in my mother's bedroom occupied one side. An old rug covered the floor, and to these I added such attractive oddments as I could find. A rickety chair, a wall bracket, and a couple of china shoes to put on it. Several pictures, and a couple of cushions. These I arranged with loving care to make a room that was, to my way of thinking, neat, charming, and comfortable. The loaded bookshelves on either side provided unlimited reading matter. Not so much the books, which disappointingly turned out to be ancient volumes or discarded textbooks, but the piles and piles of old magazines. These had been accumulated through the years. The Century, Harper's, The Ladies' Home Journal, Youth's Companion, and, best of all, St. Nicholas. To leave the everyday world below and climb the stairs to this snug nest with a juicy apple and a host of storybook friends for company was joy beyond words. Some of the stories in the St. Nicholas are still fresh in my mind today. In one of them, From Sue to Susan, a tomboy sent to boarding school to learn to be a lady was almost expelled when a jealous classmate planted a pack of cigarettes, they were called cubibs, in her bureau drawer and told the hall teacher they were there. Fortunately, the evildoer had a change of heart, and right prevailed. The Crimson Sweater, a football story, was mostly for boys, but I liked it anyway. I think it was by Ralph Henry Barber, a regular contributor to the magazine. The heroine of the Betty series by Carolyn Wells was a teenager who rose from rags to riches by inheriting a fortune, and the Lass of the Silver Sword and the League of the Signet Ring introduced me to a group of college girls who seemed deliciously sophisticated. Less daring, but casting a spell all its own, was The Lucky Sixpence, a tale of Philadelphia during the Revolution. Harper's Magazine and The Century were over my head, though sometimes I found in their dignified pages something I could understand. The Ladies' Home Journal was closer to my level, and it had pictures to boot. I had already cut out its Letty Lane paper dolls with their extensive wardrobes. And I found in one copy of the journal a play by a, to me, new writer, James M. Barrie, The Girl Who Had No Charm, which I remembered through the years, joyfully recognizing an old friend when I saw the 1923 London production of What Every Woman Knows. What today's psychologists would say about a little girl's stolen hours in this attic retreat, I do not know. But I do know that I found there a precious world all my own.
So swim in the pool. pool, you'd play hooky from school. Good old summer time. You'd play Ring a Rosie with Jim, Kate, and Josie. Good old summer time.
Chapter 8, Main Street. Plain living and high thinking was the rule in Chapel Hill at the turn of the century. The hard-pressed days of Reconstruction were close enough to be a dark memory. There had been so little money then that people had learned to make do without it, spending unbelievably little, putting their minds on higher things. A friend of my mother's told me that, when she was a child, her black nurse spoke with the utmost contempt of a little girl who wore a pretty new dress to a party. The best people couldn't afford new dresses, and other folks ought to be ashamed to wear them. By 1900, most Chapel Hillians had enough to get along comfortably in a modest way. This manner of life seemed to suit everybody, including the merchants who supplied the daily needs of the village. On Franklin Street, in the long block in the center of town, their stores maintained stocks of simple necessities held over year after year, with a few seasonal additions from time to time. One of these merchants was Mr. McCauley, whose dry goods store was across from the Methodist Church. The dark, low building was crowded with bolts of yard goods, spools of thread in wooden cabinets, now collector's pieces, buttons, braids, bindings, and other sewing supplies, too numerous to mention. Mr. McCauley presided over all these with a dignified courtesy that created an elegant atmosphere which practically guaranteed the high quality of his wares. Surely such superior surroundings could house only the very best. One day my mother needed needles, and, opening the packet to examine them, exclaimed in surprise, "Why, Mr. McCauley, these are all rusty." Mr. McCauley scrutinized the needles and had to admit that she was right. Deep rust encrusted the whole pack. "Ah, to be sure," he agreed. "Yes, there does seem to be some rust. But, as you know, Mrs. Toy, every lady had in her workbasket an emery bag to take care for such an emergency." Whether my mother bought the needles, I do not know. But if she didn't feel like using her emery, she might have found other needles at Mr. Tankersley's, two doors down the street, or at Mr. Durham's, or Mr. Andrews, up at the corner of Columbia. Tankersley's occupied a narrow building at the outer edge of the family's front yard. The store was small, but it had a special advantage. You could see everything in it as you edged along the narrow aisle. And the little room was light and pleasant. I think it had once housed the village post office, before Uncle Sam moved his mail service to a larger building on the other side of the street, beyond the Methodist Church. Durham's store on the southeast corner of Franklin and Columbia Streets was larger than Tankersley's, and, in addition to yard goods and notions, sold shirts, shoes, overalls, and other masculine necessities. Above it, on the second floor, reached by an outside staircase, was Mrs. Williamson's millinery shop, an honored institution. Here every spring and fall was held an opening, a courtesy title, since the shop was never closed, that was attended by all the ladies in town. For weeks beforehand, Mrs. Williamson and her assistant, who changed nearly every year but was always a smart young lady brought down by Mrs. Williamson from her buying trips to Baltimore, had spent weeks fashioning stylish creations. Hats were the crowning features of feminine wardrobes and absolute necessities, since no costume was complete without one. Even for marketing errands and neighborly visits, they were de rigueur, and, of course, the only time a lady entered the church uncovered was when she lay in her coffin. I remember the dry, strawy smell of Mrs. Williamson's shop, the profuse display of hats, some lavishly decorated, colorful and daring, others sensibly sedate, the showcases filled with beautiful roses, lilies, daisies, poppies and cherries, ribbons galore, feathers, plumes, and quills. Eager-eyed ladies milled about, on beauty bent. My mother chose for me a leghorn with a white ribbon and three pink rosebuds in front, and this accomplished, looked around for something for herself. Mrs. Horace Williams rushed up to her. "Oh, Mrs. Toy," she begged, "do let me help you select your hat. You know I have to sit behind you in church every Sunday." On the opposite corner of Franklin Street was Andrew's Dry Goods and Grocery Store, a real emporium consisting of two buildings thrown together. Here you could get just about everything you needed, including shoes. Buster Brown blue ribbon shoes for me. Dress materials, Butterick patterns, sewing supplies, men's under and outer wear, and ladies' unmentionables such as corsets. There were sweaters for everybody, but few, if any, ready-mades for women and children. Even nightgowns and shirtwaists were made at home, usually by a seamstress. Stella Odom was ours, who came for a week, spring and fall, or by one of the women who eked out modest livings by taking in sewing in their homes. Groceries and farm supplies filled the other half of the building. Barrels of sugar and molasses, kerosene oil, chicken feed, and home-cured hams. Live chickens and turkeys were kept in the backyard of the store, a popular gathering place for men and boys of all ages. This became a kind of sports center, the favorite sport being marbles. Heated contests took place on the playing field beside the chicken coops, where the hard-packed ground was like cement. Klutz's store, in the middle of the business block, has become a legend, immortalized in the hearts of old-timers as the place where you could get what you wanted, when you wanted it, whether you could pay or not. It was jam-packed with all manner of merchandise, piles of this and bags of that, overflowing into the crowded aisles, where, if you hunted long enough, you could be pretty sure to find the desired article. The front showcase was filled with candy. Lowney's chocolates came in boxes decorated with pictures of beautiful ladies, and there were trays of gumdrops, caramels, marshmallows, and peppermints to tempt less affluent purchasers. Further back in the store were shelves full of used textbooks. This department did a thriving business, for here you could get hard cash for hated volumes you were glad to be rid of, and could buy others marked with helpful notes by previous users. Close by were tablets, notebooks, pencils, and ink, and, since students were the store's best customers, boxes upon boxes of men's shoes. Across the aisle were edibles of all descriptions: cheese, crackers, sardines, pickles, potted ham, corned beef, and the new drink, Coca-Cola, that people were beginning to like. Dr. A.A. Klutz was a kindly, pink-cheeked, gray-haired gentleman who left the running of the store pretty much in the hands of his assistants, a succession of students who became knowledgeable in the retail business, and Ernest, the colored man who knew everything and everybody connected with the establishment, and could have run the place if he'd had to. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.